is 7 o'clock.
Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pace. Tonight, we take a bi-coastal view of climate change. According to recent data from the U.S. Drought Monitor, almost all of California is experiencing extreme to exceptional drought, and statewide storage is only at about 50% of normal for this time of year. And while recent Pacific storms brought marginal reprieve to Shasta and Oroville, the state's largest reservoirs, meteorologists say they will do little to reverse what may be the state's worst dry spell in 1,200 years. Amid these reports, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration just released a study finding no conclusive evidence linking human-induced climate change to the current drought. So what is causing the current drought, and how can information about those causes inform how we prepare for and mitigate the effects of future dry periods? And how is the drought similar to other extreme weather events like Hurricane Sandy back on the East Coast? And how can lessons from past disasters help us address this one? Joining me in the studio tonight to discuss these questions and more is Adam Sobel. He is professor at Columbia University's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory and the Foo Foundation School of Engineering and Applied Sciences. He is an atmospheric scientist who specializes in the dynamics of climate and weather. A major focus of his current research is extreme events such as hurricanes, tornadoes, floods, and droughts, and their relationship to climate change and climate variability. He's received numerous awards, and in fact, tomorrow will receive an Ascent Award from the Atmospheric Sciences section of the American Geophysical Union. Adam is an author or co-author of over 100 peer-reviewed scientific articles, and his book Storm Surge, Hurricane Sandy, Our Changing Climate and Extreme Weather of the Past and Future has just been published by HarperCollins. Welcome, Adam Sobel.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And as always, we welcome you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes, but I'll give you that phone number now. It's 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134, or you can email us or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment at the KALW website. So, as I mentioned in the beginning of the program there, I wanted to take a bi-coastal view of climate change because we're experiencing a drought here, and we had a pretty warm summer or late fall here for the Bay Area, whereas we've been hearing about storms back east. And then, of course, Sandy keeps coming up as a harbinger of things to come on the East Coast. So if we look at the extremes, the two coasts, tell us what we can understand about our weather patterns in general and how climate change kind of interacts with that.
Right. So it's important to understand, first of all, that the weather and the climate, in fact, vary naturally on many timescales. The weather comes and goes chaotically in the sense of chaos theory, meaning that it's hard to predict. And even the climate, even on very timescales from 1 year to the next, you have El Nino events that have a big influence here on the West Coast in particular. And then even from decade to decade and even century to century and longer, the climate varies naturally. And so any given weather event has a large component of natural variability, whereas climate change is a slow push in one direction on top of that due to human emissions of greenhouse gases. So one way you can think about it, to make a simple analogy, is if you think about your bank account, your bank account's always going up and down. If you get a paycheck, it goes up. If you get a, you know, buy something or pay your rent or get a parking ticket, you know, that you have to pay, it goes down. It's always fluctuating. And at any given moment, whether you're up or down is going to depend on that. But if you get a small raise, then over time, your bank account, and if everything else stays the same, then over time, your bank account's going to slowly increase. But on any given day, if the raise wasn't too big, your balance is not going to be strongly affected by that. It's going to be affected by your fact that you just paid your rent, you just got your paycheck. So that's sort of the overall context. So when we ask, did climate change influence some weather event, that's the first thing we have to understand, that any influence, even if there is an influence, it's going to be, for any single event, it's going to be small compared to natural variability.
And so that's an important detail, because I imagine that there are people out there who think that the drought we're in the midst of here in California, a pretty dramatic sounding one based on the statistics I read a little bit ago, suggests that, oh, this is it. It's here. Climate change is here. And what you're saying right now and the NOAA report that came out just recently, say that no, not so fast. But it doesn't mean that we shouldn't worry about climate change.
Right. So there's general issues and then there's specific issues to each event. So in general, as I say, for any single event, climate change so far is going to have a relatively small role. But it still can be the case that over time, first of all, there can be some climate change influence. As one example, in some cases, we can detect that already. The Australian heat wave of their last summer, for example, some recent studies have very strongly indicated that the probability of that happening was much greater because of the human influence on climate. And that's the kind of statement you can make. At best, you can say, well, the probability of such an event increasing is greater than it would have been without human-induced climate change. Even if you can't make that kind of statement, you can often say, well, this event may not have had a strong climate change influence yet, but we expect in the future that the probability of such events will increase. In the case of the California drought, there's some more specific things you can say, and I'm using as my source here the report you just mentioned, sponsored by NOAA. The lead author is my colleague Richard Seeger at Columbia's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory, with several co-authors from Columbia and from NASA and NOAA. And they found a small role for they found that this event was predominantly due to natural variability. And they do this by using climate models, and they can show using those that it's attributable to natural fluctuations in sea surface temperatures in the Pacific, as well as natural fluctuations in the atmosphere, that those are the primary causes for the low rainfall in the last three winters. Now, they've been critiqued somewhat by others who have argued that the warming climate makes the water that's in the soil evaporate more readily, and that contributes to the drought. And that's probably true. I don't think the authors of the NOAA report would dispute that. They would just argue that if it had been raining normally, nobody would have perceived a drought at this point, so that's the primary cause. So you can sometimes make more specific statements than just saying, well, and that's, in this case, that's what they've done, and those are the conclusions at this point.
Would it be accurate to say that it's the weather variations that cause the drought, but it's climate change, the fact that we've had warmer temperatures recently, that are exacerbating the effects of whatever variations we're experiencing?
Yeah, I don't know that influence has been quantified specifically yet, but that's the kind of thing we expect, yes. We expect that for the same amount of rainfall, the warmer temperatures will evaporate water from the soil more readily. It's also worth stating some of the other effects we expect climate change to have based on the best climate models. We expect for the southwest United States overall, as well as northern Mexico, that those areas will become drier, significantly drier. That's a very robust result from climate models. By robust means all the climate models more or less agree about it. California is slightly different than the rest of the Southwest, as I understand it. So in California, actually the projection from the climate models is that the winters will get wetter, but the spring will get drier. So you'll have a shorter and sharper, as they say in the report, wet season. And so the projection for California is a little more complicated, but in all cases, we expect the warmer temperatures to deplete soil moisture in addition to whatever the reduction in rainfall is doing, yes.
So let's head back east for a moment,
yeah,
then, and let's talk about Hurricane Sandy, which is the subject of your new book. So tell us about how you take the concepts that we've been grappling with in the last few minutes and apply that to what happened there. Hurricane Sandy, also this natural variation, but with an effect that was exacerbated by sea level rise that was caused by climate change?
Right. So Sandy was a hurricane that in its last moments before landfall transitioned to a extratropical storm. Extratropical doesn't mean more than tropical. It means the type of storm you get in higher latitudes in winter, a winter type of storm. So with hurricanes, even more than with droughts, because hurricanes happen very quickly and droughts take a longer time, hurricanes are even more difficult to attribute an individual hurricane to climate change. We can make some general statements about how we think hurricanes will change. We think they'll get more intense. There may actually be fewer of them, according to the latest models, but because they're more intense, the chance of a really intense one could go up. But Sandy, because it was making this transition to winter type of storm, was really unusual by the sort of global standards of hurricanes, and so we know even less about what those will do in climate change. So the current science does not really allow us to attribute Sandy, the storm, to climate change in any direct way. It doesn't mean there's no connection, but the current science doesn't show it. The direct connection is with sea level rise, as you said. So the sea level has risen in the east coast of around the New York area by about a foot in the last 100 years or so, of which about two-thirds is due to the warming climate. The rest is due to the land actually sinking, which is natural in our region. And so the Sandy's storm surge, which is the wind pushing the water onto shore, which is what caused all the damage, was about 9 feet. So 9 feet on top of the tide. It happened to be high tide, unfortunately, so the total 14 feet above the low tide mark was how high the water was. So the better part of a foot being climate change is small addition, but not necessarily insignificant. So that's the role, the direct role for climate change in Sandy. And as we look to the future, it's also the most certain factor that is definitely increasing our risk of future events like that. Because as the sea level rises, and we expect anywhere from a foot to maybe 3 feet is not unreasonable, even 6 feet is not out of the question by the end of the century, then a 9-foot storm surge would only need to be 6 feet or maybe even only 3 feet to produce the same total water level. And a storm producing those lesser surges is much, much more common. So with a higher sea level, we'd have Sandy-type floods much more often in a warmer climate with higher seas, and that's the real concern for the future.
That was exactly what I was going to get to next, which is where's the tipping point here? Where is the effect of climate change, given it's as insidious and gradual as you describe it? Where does it tip over to the fact where, you know, yeah, it's been building, and now, you know, to use a no pun intended here, the dam breaks, right? And it's right. Sort of like, this is really we're now seeing it. It's been gradual all this time, but now the balance of the damage is coming from climate change. How long till we see something like that? When will we know that we've seen climate change being the predominant factor in situations like these?
That's a difficult question to answer, and it really depends on what type of event you're talking about. And that to answer that question precisely is really pushing the limits of current science, and I don't know that I can give a precise answer, but I think we can say a few things. First of all, there's no single point. There's no, you know, all these changes are happening gradually, but although then given it randomly, single extreme events occur, which make us sharply aware of them. The community of climate scientists has pinned 2 degrees Celsius of global average warming as the mark of dangerous climate change that we're trying to avoid by reducing greenhouse emissions, and that's sort of the point of departure for the international negotiations. Now, 2 degrees Celsius is, some may say that's an arbitrary number, and that's sort of true. Any number, single number, is arbitrary, and climate change manifests itself regionally very differently. And so there's nothing really magic about 2 degrees, but it's good to have targets to shoot for. And it also doesn't mean, by the way, I mean, at this point, we're unlikely to keep ourselves at 2 degrees warming the way things are going. But that doesn't mean we should give up, because 3 degrees or 4 degrees are worse than 2 degrees, so we should keep trying. But I think in terms of sea level, I mean, when the seas get close to being on land, even without a storm, you know, is where you start to have problems. You know, there are some places that are, with a foot or two of sea level rise, are going to have regular flooding even without a storm, just due to the tides. Florida, for example, almost the entire state of Florida is in serious trouble because it's very low-lying, and the land is mostly limestone, which means that even seawalls won't work because the water will just come from below. The limestone's very porous, so the water can come from below. So, but certainly, 3 feet of sea level rise for New York would mean that we'd be flooded very often if the infrastructure stays as it is now, for example. Of course, sea level rise is also flooding is only one factor. I mean, the most certain thing about global warming is the warming itself. It's going to be very hot. San Francisco is not one of the most places in the biggest trouble, but places like New York and the further southeast, the summers are going to be very difficult.
Some people, you know, joke, you know, depending on how you, if you don't like the fog, you know, global warming might be a good thing for San Francisco in terms of weather. But I'm joking there, of course. But the issue that you brought up just bring of sea level rise has been discussed on this program many times before, which is the same concern we have here in the Bay Area and around the Bay itself. So what are your what's your understanding of the predictions around what the margins are for sea level rise here?
So I'm not an expert on San Francisco's topography. I did look it up before coming in here. It seems that the most low-lying areas around the South Bay, especially, and just, you know, just taking the tram in this morning from Fisherman's Wharf to downtown, you could see that at the edge of downtown there along the Embarcadero, it's really only a few feet down to the sea. So I can't give you a precise report, but it's, I think overall, by the way, I think San Francisco is one of the better off places in the Pacific Coast as a whole because it's relatively steep. I mean, you have a lot of hills here, a lot of topography, unlike, say, the Gulf Coast, you know, of Louisiana, Mississippi, which has huge flat, you know, areas that so that a little bit of sea level rise floods them. I mean, you're better off here than many places, but it's still going to be an issue.
So then as we talk about this this issue of climate change versus natural variations in weather, what do you think the impact of this NOAA report is going to be on those folks out there who are still to this day naysayers of climate change? Do you have a sense of how they may use this in a certain way to advance their agenda?
Sure. This is a real problem in my field. It's a communication challenge that we really face. It's important to say that the authors of this report, and I think I can speak for them in this respect, like pretty much every climate scientist working in the field, are fully in agreement with the consensus that human emissions of greenhouse gases are warming the climate, and that's a serious problem. And more specifically, the authors of this report have written many other studies showing how the Southwest U.S. as a whole is very likely to experience increasing drought conditions as global warming proceeds. And so the statements about this study are rather narrowly focused on this specific drought. This is always an issue when we talk about extreme events and climate change. It's always difficult, given current science, to make strong statements that climate change has a major role in a single weather event. So, you know, the media asks us, did climate change cause this event? And if we're honest, what the answers we give come out sounding a little bit like no. But then those who are inclined to hear it this way hear that there is no climate change and they don't need to be worried about it, when that couldn't be further from the truth. It's just that you have to separate the question from, is there climate change? Is it increasing the odds of some type of event occurring? And how strong a statement can you make about a specific event? And the more we go from the general statements about many of types of events to specific events, the more uncertainty has to come into our statements. And so it's perpetually a communication challenge. And we saw this very clearly, for example, after, to name another one that your listeners are probably familiar with, Typhoon Haiyan in 2013 in the Philippines was, as far as we know, the strongest typhoon to make landfall since we have data on how strong typhoons were at landfall. So it causes tremendous destruction. And many of my colleagues, including myself, were being asked questions, you know, in the media, what did climate change cause the storm? And we had to say, well, you know, you can't attribute this one event to climate change, etc. But in the case of Haiyan, it's exactly the type of event that we do expect to occur. Sorry, we do expect to occur more often in a warming climate. We expect more intense tropical cyclones, typhoons, and hurricanes. And Haiyan, being the strongest one ever observed at landfall, was exactly the kind of thing we expect to see more often as the warming climate. So even though we couldn't attribute it precisely, it is in some sense a harbinger of what we expect. So we always have to balance these, and it's, you know, you can't stop people from hearing what they want to hear. And we have to, as scientists, we have to do our best to be honest while still making clear what the realities are on all aspects of the issue.
So right, and given what's at stake here, how do scientists, or how should scientists and the scientific community, really try to make their points in ways that still keep them true to their method, which requires them to speak in probabilities and have lots of sort of clauses that sort of explain the limitations of any prediction or any association from how do you get at that, keep that, but at the same time make sure that people don't lose sight of the long-term concerns that are, as you've already pointed out, are not letting up. They're just, it's the sort of the slow roll of the train.
Right. I think we just have to start by saying what the science is about climate change, that we are warming the climate. We understand that from many different sources. We understand what many of the impacts are going to be. Some of that we can see already. And then we have to go from there to the specifics of each event. And it's important to say, by the way, that we used to always say you can't attribute any one event to climate change. That's no longer quite true. The science has advanced, and the models we use to do these kind of studies have advanced to the point that we can make, in some cases, fairly specific statements about to what extent a given event can be attributed to climate change. And in fact, this NOAA report by Seeger and colleagues is doing exactly that. Now, they come to the conclusion that in this event, the climate change influence, at least on the rainfall, is small, but the models allow them to distinguish that. Now, those kinds of studies are easier to do for certain types of events than others. They're easier to do for heat waves, because heat waves are related to global warming in the simplest way, in the way that you would think. It's warmer, so you're more likely to get a heat wave. Droughts, our climate models do pretty well at, because a drought is a slowly evolving thing. It's the average conditions over a long time, so the models are better at that. As you get to fast weather events like hurricanes and things, it becomes more difficult to do those kinds of assessments. But the science keeps getting better, and so I think we just have to keep trying to communicate all the dimensions of it as well as we can. And also to try to separate science from politics, because what's unfortunate in this country's political debate is that whether you believe in the science of climate has become a litmus test of what your politics is, and it really shouldn't be that way. The science is what it is, regardless of your politics, and where the politics can and should come in is in arguments of what we do about it, and there's room for all political views there. So I think that's the other thing we have to do, is we have to argue very forcefully about the scientific facts. There's really no debate on those outside of the normal processes of science. But then the conclusions one draws from that about societal action are another matter, and politics should come into that.
And we'll get back to that more a little later on the program. I just want to reintroduce our conversation tonight. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing drought, climate change, Superstorm Sandy, all of it with atmospheric scientist Adam Sobel of Columbia University. And we invite you, our listeners, to call in with your questions or comments on this topic. I'll give you that phone number right now. It's 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Do you have any questions about the current drought and its connection to climate change? Are you having some questions about all this rain we're having and whether it's doing anything to help reverse that drought? 415-841-4134. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@klw.org or post a comment at the KALW website. So let's go to our first caller. Lisa, welcome to the program.
Thank you for accepting my call. I also was a little bit worried about your speaker, because at the beginning when I heard him say that it was gradual and that this specific event was not due to necessarily not due to climate change, it sort of brought up some concerns for me, because, I mean, for example, I came to California 30 years ago, and I remember it used to rain here from November all the way to April, and May is when the jasmine would come out, and you'd have beautiful flowers blooming and everything. And so this drought does not, I mean, it's gradual in the sense of a 30-year timeline, but 30 years and even the last 200 years, which is the industrial area, the industrial time, there has been a major change in the weather patterns in these past 200 years, and we have, I mean, I'm sure as a climate scientist knows, this does not seem to me as if it would be a normal Earth cycle. It seems pretty dangerous. And as far as tipping points are concerned, I mean, I read the book by James Hansen, Storms of My Grandchildren, and he mentions a tipping point that is pretty much closer than we imagine, especially if we could take into consideration the methane released by the Arctic tundra that is thawing, and also if we also take into consideration the potential for the XL pipeline project, the tar sands project being right now in question. If that comes to pass, then we are probably facing a much dire future and a much more abrupt climate situation than we would ever have imagined. And my last comment is that I understand that the Koch brothers has given money to NPR and therefore has reduced the amount of reporters dealing with climate change issues. So I'm very happy that you have this issue on right now. However, I would like to stress that we really do need to have more climate scientists on that will stress the issue about fossil fuels and the divestment from fossil fuel companies.
Okay, Lisa, thanks for your very extended comments there. It was very great to hear your personal experience over the last 30 years here and also all the other reading that you're doing on this matter. Thanks for your call, and I'll have you take your answer off the air. So, Adam, lots to respond to there, potentially.
Right. I don't know if I can cover all of that, but to start with the issue of this drought being different from what's happened in the past, it's important to understand, again, that the climate varies unnaturally on many timescales, including very long timescales. So what we humans perceive as changes in our lifetime can be natural. It doesn't mean that they necessarily are. It doesn't mean that climate change doesn't play a role, but they can be natural. So, for example, she talked about 30 years. Actually, according to this NOAA report, this drought is the second worst in the historical record since 1895, and the worst was in the 70s, a three-year period in the 70s. So that's just before the period the caller referred to. So it's not unprecedented even in this 100-year, a little over 100-year period. And if you go further back over the last 1,000 years, there's evidence from tree rings that California in particular, and the Southwest in general, have seen even worse droughts protracted over a much longer period of time. So the climate system does have within it the capability to produce very severe droughts in this region. It's a naturally dry region, and for them to come and go over very long periods of time, even compared to human life. So when we ask, is human-induced climate change playing a role, that's a good question, and it may be, but the fact that it's different from what one person's experienced in their life doesn't prove it one way or the other.
Mm. I have a question about this capacity for such wide swings in weather. Is there some understanding as to why that happens? Is there some sort of, I don't know, evolutionary reason for it?
Understanding, yeah. Yes. It depends. I mean, in general, it depends what timescale you look on. If you look at the timescale of million years, there's glacial and interglacial periods that come, you know, over tens and hundreds of thousands, and those are related to changes in the Earth's orbit. The Earth's orbit is elliptical around the sun, but the gravity from the other planets jiggles it around just a little bit, and over very long periods of time, that causes the ice ages in ways that are partially but somewhat understood, and those are called the Milankovitch cycles after the scientists who discovered this phenomenon long ago. In terms of this region, particularly in the droughts, some of it appears to be related to variability in the sea surface temperature in the Pacific. Everybody's heard of El Nino by now. And El Nino, although it comes and goes every few years, there can also be longer period, slower variations in that system, and that influences the west coast of the U.S. very much. And some of it is just natural variability within the atmosphere.
Just random.
Some of it appears to be random.
Yeah. All right. Let's go to another caller, Mahadevan, and he's calling from Oakland. Did I get your name right?
Yes, you did. Thank you. it's a very interesting program, and I just want to say a few words, basically supporting what your guest is saying in response to the previous caller about her 30-year experience in the Bay Area. I think the challenge, as the speaker has made abundantly clear, is one of communication. and this fixation that people have with looking at what we might call the near-term fluctuations and desperately wanting to find a causal relationship between those and climate change. And an analogy I might give, which sort of is somewhat different than the analogy your guest gave about the bank account, is the stock market. If one were just fixated on the stock market on a day-to-day basis, one would have a notion that there are these wild swings. Oh, it went up by 200 points, it went down by 300, and one would be clueless as to what the trend was. But if one stepped back from that and just looked at the overall trend over a decade or two decades, one would see a different trend altogether, just something that went up. Of course, the analogy is poor at some level, which is these Nine Sigma events, terrible crashes and things like that that are totally unpredictable. But weather is inherently nonlinear. It's very difficult to quantify it on any short time scale. And so I think the challenge is for people to stop looking for comfort from someone assuring them, oh yeah, you know, that terrible storm we just had, Sandy, that was definitely due to climate change. No, 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 no. As the guest has said many times over the past 20 minutes, at least step back and look at the big trends. Think about the fact that if the sea level if the sea level is, you know, 2 feet higher than it was before, then a 4-foot storm is as devastating as a 6-foot storm was earlier. And eventually you'll get to a point where the average storm, which before didn't do anything to us, is now wreaking havoc. And that's this sort of creeping, pernicious effect of climate change. And I sympathize with your guest because I think he's doing a marvelous job of communicating something that's very difficult to communicate. That's all.
I'm going to hold you on the line just there for a second, Madhavan, because this is where the politics comes in, yes, at least for a moment. So you were talking about the long view as being the correct way to really look at how things are going. But policymakers, no matter which side of the climate change question they may be on, their view is, you could argue, either short-sighted or necessarily very short view. Right, you look at budgets over 2 years, 5-year cycles. You look at votes and you look at election cycles that are very short. How do you bridge this gap with a science that tells you take the long view and policymakers that say we've got to go with what's right in front of us right now? And so things like Sandy or a drought, dramatic events, are what count or what get attention. And I'd like either of you to comment on that.
Well, yeah, I'd like to say something about that. I think that you raise a good point. I think that, you know, even if we can't attribute a single event strongly to climate change, given current science, some of these extreme events draw our attention to how vulnerable we are to the disasters that the atmosphere can deliver. And then if we combine that with the understanding that the human-induced climate change is making some kinds of events more probable over the long term, then that's a very compelling, that should be a compelling enough message on its own. So, for example, to use the example of Typhoon Haiyan again, last year when Typhoon Haiyan happened and killed somewhere close to 10,000 people in the Philippines and caused tremendous damage there, at the same time as many meteorologists were saying, well, you can't attribute the one storm to climate change, a guy named Yeb Sanyo, who's one of the negotiators for the Philippines in the international climate negotiations process, was saying, look, this typhoon is a symbol of what climate change is doing to our country, and you guys have to stop emitting greenhouse gases because this is killing us. And he wasn't wrong either, in the sense that even though you can't attribute that one storm to climate change, it's the kind of thing that we do expect to happen more often. And the fact that that can kill 10,000 people in the Philippines, those two facts alone should be enough to make us take it seriously. So I think that's part of the communication challenge. We have to learn how to get that across. It shouldn't be necessary to attribute each event to climate change in order to make us concerned about it. Mm-hmm.
Mahadevan, do you want to add something there?
Well, coming back to the politics of the whole thing, the problem is that climate change, that geologists, geophysical fluid dynamicists, really have a difficult challenge, because let me try a different analogy. If you look at something that's far more deterministic, which is, you know, asteroids, comets, and things like that, if the politicians asked a bunch of astronomers, hey, you know, what's the likelihood that that asteroid that's just been detected is going to come and bang into the Earth? They would say somewhat more unequivocally, look, we've tracked the orbit and we've calculated it, and it's just not going to happen. It's going to miss the Earth by, you know, 500,000 miles. It's not even going to come near the moon, whatever. And they'll all stand behind it. The challenge here is that a good climatologist, and your guest is a shining example of one such, will say, hey, look, there are some aspects of this problem that are essentially chaotic, and therefore we're not going to stand up and be, you know, unequivocal about certain aspects of this. The moment they smell that, the politicians who are not at all trained to think in that scientific manner will interpret what they choose to. For example, they'll say, look at this, these guys can't even agree with one another, so they must not know what they're doing. So who cares about this climate change? And in particular, the naysayers pounce on that kind of equivocation to their benefit and to the detriment of society at large.
Well, thank you, Mahadevan, for your comments there. Thanks for participating.
Thank you. I'll go back to the radio now because I'm going to enjoy the rest of this program. Thank you.
And that program that you're listening to is City Visions here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at kalw.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing climate change with atmospheric scientist, or do you prefer climatologist?
Either one's okay. I say atmospheric scientist, but climatologist is fine.
Adam Sobel of Columbia University. He's with the Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory and the Foo Foundation School of Engineering and Applied Sciences, and also has a new book out called Storm Surge, Hurricane Sandy, Our Changing Climate and Extreme Weather of the Past and Future, just published by HarperCollins. We have a couple of phone lines open, 415-841-4134 to join our conversation. Again, we have 415-841-4134 is the number to dial to join our conversation. Email us at cityvisions@klw.org or post comment at the KLW website. I'm a little confused about who I go to next here. We're going to go next to Karen from Berkeley. Welcome, Karen.
Oh, good evening. Yeah, I think this is a very interesting discussion. Everybody knows that climate change is here. Everybody knows we're in a drought. Everybody knows there hasn't been any rain. Everybody knows the farmers in the Central Valley have had their water drastically reduced, and their trees are dying, and we could just look around and see that. I live out in Alameda, and this last year they turned the water off on all the East Bay regional parks and put up signs all over the lawns that said, brown is the new green. So it is upon us, and whether NOAA or any scientific or political party wants to talk about the philosophy of climate change, it is here. So what are we supposed to do? Why don't we have the organizations like your guest ask all the news medias and the TV stations and radio stations every day to have a public service announcements of how to conserve water. Don't run the water when you're brushing your teeth. Maybe only shower 3 times a week instead of 7 times a week. We need some practical advice for people because we all know that it is in front of us. And also, we know that every leaf is a carbon absorber. And it's global warming due to carbon rise, and we've been cutting down the rainforest, and now they're talking about cutting down up in the Arctic, and they're cutting the trees in Russia, and forests are coming down everywhere. So we should have also, if we want to help the climate, why don't we have massive tree planting? Like Wangari Maathai, who got a Nobel Peace Prize, she planted 1 million trees to reforest Africa. If we were to start a reforestation program, let's say we even take one state in this country and get kids or people that are not working, plant trees. We could begin to reoxygenate the planet. We could begin to clean the air of deadly carbons. So we live symbiotically with trees. So I think we need some maybe practical approaches to a global warming, climate change, and the drought. And I've lived in California for 35 years, and I'm from back east, and we are definitely, this is not going to change. And we can't have an announcement and say, oh, it's raining, the drought is over. We are in a permanent, permanent drought, and people have to know how to conserve water, not to use it, not to, you know, hose their sidewalks down. I still see people hosing their sidewalks down. Mm. I'm horrified by it.
Right.
So that's my comment, and I think we need to get all these scientific organizations to get real practical and get on the news and tell people, this is what you can do now, every day, in every public school, every building, and make the announcement of what are the things, what are the measures we can take to conserve water. And not cut trees down that don't need to be. I still see trees coming down for building and developments. So that should be completely made illegal.
Okay, I'm gonna have to cut you off there. But thank you, Karen, for your passion on this topic.
Thank you. Have a good evening.
I think we're going to Alexis next. Is that right? Yeah, Alexis, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having this program. I didn't hear the entire thing, but I was listening to most of it, and I'm just a little bit confused by the report because I don't understand how you can rule out climate change as a factor when all parts of ecosystems are interconnected. We know from Bill McKibben, 350 million parts per whatever it is, that once you exceed 350, you start getting into irreversible climate disruption. I believe we're past 400 million at this point. So that's in the atmosphere. So, yes, the report has factors that it's considering, but how can you, you know, it's like the elephant in the room. How can you say that's not contributing to part of what you're analyzing? And I will take my question off the air. Thank you for having this really important show.
Thanks, Alexis. Adam.
Right. So it's right. 350.org is about about the percentage of carbon dioxide in the air. So it's, we are now over 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide. That's how much there is. And it's important to say, again, that this NOAA report by a group of scientists at Columbia and federal scientists led by my colleague Richard Seeger, this report is not debating the existence of human-induced climate change in any way. What it is trying to do is assess its role in the current drought and specifically in the lack of rainfall. It may be that the warmer temperatures have exacerbated the drought by evaporating the water. They don't contest that point. It's about the rainfall. And the way they do it is by taking climate models, which are our best attempts to simulate how the climate system operates using the laws of physics. And they're very close relatives of the models that are used to make your weather forecasts every day. So we have some idea how to do this. These are computer simulations of the atmosphere and ocean and land components of the land system that are relevant for climate. And so what they do is they put in the ocean temperatures over the last few years, and they run these models many, many times, and they see if they can get the models to reproduce the drought without due to natural factors. And the answer is more or less yes. That's part of the answer. And the other answer is that when they look at these same models and do simulations where they increase carbon dioxide and let both the atmosphere and ocean respond and let the climate warm, which has all the effects that we all know about, what happens to California doesn't look like this current drought, because what happens to California is it actually rains more in the winter, according to these models, whereas we're seeing it rain less over the last three winters. So it just doesn't look like what's projected. So it's not to say, again, climate change is happening. It's real. It's a serious problem. It is very likely to have serious impacts for California as well as most of the rest of the planet. But when it comes to this event, the best available science doesn't allow us to attribute it. So I think we need to be able to hold in our minds at the same time the fact that an extreme event can happen. It can have serious consequences. At the same time, climate change is happening and has serious consequences, while yet the two may not be the same thing. We have to learn how to accept that. And I want to go back to something else the previous caller said about what should we do about it, and we should use water more efficiently.
This was Karen from Berkeley.
Karen from Berkeley, right. Mm-hmm. That's absolutely true. And if you could get, you know, people on the air every day to say that, that'd be great. I think it's important to understand, and this is another connection between coast to coast. I mean, another connection between climate change influence on, another connection between disasters on the two coasts, between Sandy in New York, for example, and the drought here in California. It's not just people taking showers and all that. California has a very archaic and inefficient system for allocating water that's basically first come, first served 100 years ago. So agriculture gets the lion's share of the water in California, although it's a small minority, a small fraction of the economy. I think something like a few percent of the economy is agriculture, whereas it's something like 70% of the water use. And it's not to say that we don't want California to have agriculture. I mean, the whole country eats the tomatoes and everything that are grown here, or that we want agriculture to not thrive. But the system as it's constructed is that whoever was in line first to get water, often as long as 100 years ago, has permanent rights to it over everyone else, no matter, and they don't have much compulsion to be efficient about it as long as it is there, as long as it keeps coming. And it's also very piecemeal across different parts of the state. If you live next to a river, you have rights to that, but if you live further away, it just depends when you got online to get the water, going back 100 years. So it's not a system, and a lot of the water rights were allocated during historically wet periods when people didn't really worry about whether there's going to be enough water or not. So it's a set of development decisions that were made when there were many fewer people living here, when the demands on the water were much less, and when there didn't seem to be a need to be more efficient and careful and fair about it. And now we're living in a very different time, but California is stuck with the legacy of that old system, and it's very politically hard to change. And the analogy to New York and Sandy is a lot of development being done in very low-lying areas that are very risky, and a lot of infrastructure being built, a lot of homes being built in places that were historically wetlands, barrier islands, and landfill, places very low to the water that are close to being flooded anyway, but it takes a big event to really flood them badly. And so when times are good and there's no flood, people build stuff, they get it insured, and then it floods and, you know, you have a catastrophe. But if we really looked at the long term of what the probabilities were of major severe weather events, we would have not built things in those places, but we have. So both coasts were left with legacies of decisions that were made without full accounting for the environmental risks. And this is not to say, I mean, maybe people didn't understand what the environmental risks were. It's not that anybody had bad intent, but that's just the legacy, what we're stuck with. And I think it's important to understand that climate change is there, but a lot of the impacts we feel from these events could be mitigated by better use of the resources we have, although often it's politically difficult to do that given the constraints that we're stuck with historically. That's not to say that climate change isn't simultaneously making the problem worse. It is in many cases. But part of the problem is not just trying to stop climate change by reducing greenhouse gas emissions, which we should absolutely be doing, but also what we call in the business call adaptation, which means learning how to deal with what's coming, whether it be natural or human-induced.
So it sounds like it's up to the politicians to make it happen, and callers like Karen and others that have expressed a lot of concern tonight. I'm curious to push a little bit more on this issue. What's the role of scientists in is it just to predict and give the models, or is there some other piece here that you need to get involved in the policy making in a way that perhaps you haven't, because it is so nuanced that you got to be in there kind of helping people and make the connections and move the policy forward?
Yeah, I think that I and many of us in my field have been evolving in the last decade or so on this. Many of us used to feel that our job as scientists was just to tell the scientific facts as objectively as possible and not to say anything that could be construed as political, because that would somehow corrupt our message and would make us seem as not credible. There have always been exceptions to that. Somebody mentioned Jim Hansen earlier. He's been taken a somewhat activist stance for a long time, and I admire him for that, frankly. I mean, I think he's done a lot of good. He was one of the first people to warn all the way back in the 80s about the seriousness of the problem. And there are others. Stephen Schneider, the late Stephen Schneider, comes to mind. But I and many of us have stayed out of the politics until recently. But I've become more politicized on this issue because compared to, say, 20 years ago, the political debate in the U.S. has gotten much more toxic, frankly. And there's a real anti-intellectual, anti-science component in our politics that I think we have to argue against, those of us who are scientists. And there's also the climate change has gotten more serious. It keeps happening. It keeps getting warmer. The science has become much more certain. And so I think that's the other part of it. So I think what's important So I've come to believe, and I think this is a personal decision for all of us, but I've come to the position that we as scientists, if we believe that the problem is serious and that it's not being taken seriously enough by those in positions of power, and I do believe that, as many of us do, I think, that we have a responsibility to speak our minds about it. But I think what's important is that we make clear when we're speaking as scientists about matters of scientific fact and when we're speaking about values, because those are two different things. I think when it comes to scientific fact, we can argue based on evidence, we can argue based on the methods of science, we can argue based on data, statistics, laws of physics, etc. When it comes to what should we do about it, none of those things apply. Those are decisions of human values, and we don't have any more right than anyone else to say what the right values are. But we have as much right as anyone else, and so many of us have come to the point of view that it's okay for us to talk about it, because there's nobody has an absolute privileged position on this. And so I've come to think that since I have the opportunity to be on shows like this and to say what I think, I'm going to do that. But at the same time, it's important to be clear what our views are, what our prejudices are. Science is practiced by human beings. It's impossible for a scientist to speak without being influenced in some way by what their views are. And so we might as well just get those out in the open, and then people can judge them as they wish. But again, that applies only when we're talking about the non-scientific part of the problem, which is the what should we do. When it comes to matters of science, we have to refer to the methods of science, which we try to make as independent of politics as we can.
I mean, I think of the term of activist judges. You know, I hear someone saying activist scientists. What do you think scientists would put at risk if more people like you do this kind of opinionating that's separate from the science that you do? Do you imagine you risk funding, or what do you see here, and how do you decide that it's worth doing?
I think if we let our politics get in the way of the practice of our science, we'll lose the respect of our peers very quickly, and that's fatal to any scientist. I mean, science functions by peer review, by the way, keeps us very honest. Some people, you know, think that one line you hear from the deniers is, well, climate scientists just want to say that climate change is a problem so they'll get funding. It really does not work like that. If I had a credible model, a credible climate model that would show that carbon dioxide doesn't warm the climate, I would get tons of funding. It doesn't, you know, the system would not, if I could really support that with evidence. And the reason we all agree on what's happening in the big picture, we disagree on a lot in climate science, but the reason we agree on the big picture that humans are warming the climate is the evidence is really incontrovertible. But there are limitations on what scientists can say. Fortunately, in the universities, we don't face that too much. And I think the government scientists can also say what they want as well, but we have to be clear. We all have to be clear that we're speaking for ourselves and not our institutions. And, I think the most important thing is that we just have to try to keep it separate from our practice of science, which has to be, you know, science can only be argued on scientific principles, which should be as apolitical as we can make them.
Mm. So let's go to a couple more calls here. I think John has been waiting patiently. John, welcome to the program.
Hi. I live in San Francisco. My question is, why not tax the individual according to how much fossil fuels they burn and create a fund that would be used for a remedy to the problem?
So we kind of do that already with corporations, right? We tax them on how much they emit, right?
Not on a national basis, no.
I mean, tax the individual, like tax the people who get into their car, how much you use when you drive to work, how much you use to heat your home, how much you use for whatever, for your lawnmower. Tax the individual according to...
Well, the fuel is already taxed. Are you saying that it should just be taxed more?
Yeah, taxed more, a San Francisco tax, that San Francisco would have a fund to use to deal with as a remedy. And also it would be sort of, instead of sugary beverage tax, a tax that the individual would have, each person would pay a certain amount depending on how much they personally use.
Right. Well, great idea. I wonder how far that will go, but thanks for suggesting it.
You're welcome.
I mean, this is one of the standard proposals that's out there. I mean, that we do have gas taxes, but they are not carbon emission taxes. In other words, gas is taxed for other reasons, but it's not tax-based. We don't have a national tax or price of any kind on carbon, and we should. Now, whether that should best be done through a carbon tax, which could be applied to individuals, corporations, everybody else, which would mean that you pay a certain amount of tax for anything that burns, that emits greenhouse gases, or whether it should be done through a cap and trade system, which would mean that, you know, you have, there are rights to emit certain amount of greenhouse gases, and those can be traded. And so that's a more market-oriented mechanism, and there's a legitimate debate about which of those is better. And this is a very good example of something that science on its own can't solve. It's a matter for economics and politics, what would be the most effective. My own views on this are I'm not an expert on it and are evolving. I used to be convinced that a carbon tax was the way to go, but I've heard some strong arguments that it wouldn't be as effective as some of us used to think it would be, and that maybe some other mechanisms are better. But it would be good if we had a price on carbon, if for no other reason than to give better economic incentives to develop renewable energy. In other words, solar and wind and non greenhouse gas emitting sources of energy are more viable the more economically competitive they are against fossil fuels, and so putting a price on carbon would make those more attractive, especially right now the price of oil happens to temporarily be very low. But even if it weren't, I mean, it would still be a good idea to make those to promote investment. If people thought there was going to be more value in solar and wind, then we'd have more investment, and the technology would get better, and the prices would keep coming down, as they have been doing anyway.
Let's go next to Philip from Brisbane. Welcome to the program, Philip.
Oh, thank you. Well, let me preface my question by saying that I'm a tree hugger and an almost faith-based believer in the power of nature's ability to heal. But I have a question. I've heard that there's really no net gain or loss when it comes to trees and other vegetation, when it comes to oxygen and CO2, because the amount of oxygen that's emitted by the tree is offset by the amount of carbon dioxide that's emitted after it decays. I was wondering if you could answer that for me.
Right. So, first of all, oxygen is really not an issue in the climate change debate or any other debate. I mean, the Earth's supply of oxygen is not in any trouble. Oxygen is 21% of the atmosphere, and the component that we can change due to anything we can do to trees is very small. Trees can have a much bigger effect on carbon dioxide because carbon dioxide is a very small fraction of the atmosphere, so trees can make a bigger dent in it. One of the other callers mentioned trees. Trees can pull carbon out of the atmosphere. I mean, any plant that grows is made in large part out of carbon, so it grows by pulling carbon in and building itself out of it. So if you when you deforest, when you cut down trees, the trees die, and some of the carbon they're made out of winds up going into the atmosphere. So that's true. And if you plant more trees, then as those trees go, they pull carbon down. So there is a role for reforestation, especially in the tropics, where a lot of rainforest has been cut down, as one caller said, in reducing carbon. In the long term, there's only so far that goes, because you can only grow so many more trees. I mean, if we keep burning fossil fuels, if we were to grow back all the trees that have in all the places that have been deforested, that would soak up some carbon for a while. But once that forest is mature, all it can do is the trees would die again and emit the carbon, and then they'd grow back, and you sort of reach a steady state. So it's not to say that we shouldn't do reforestation, but it's not a cure-all.
So believe it or not, Adam, the hour has passed. Any last words for how our listeners can get more engaged in this debate?
Well, I think you can learn the science, and you can also really vote. I think it would, whatever one's politics are, I think if you take this issue seriously, what we should do is express that so that our leaders believe that it's a serious issue, which I think it, up until now at least, it's starting to change, but up until now I don't think it's been taken as seriously as it ought to be.
So I want to thank you, Adam Sobel, Professor of Atmospheric Science at Columbia University. Your new book out, Storm Surge, Hurricane Sandy, Our Changing Climate, Extreme Weather of the Past and Future, just published by HarperCollins. Thanks so much for joining me this evening.
Thank you for having me.
For a link to this and other City Visions shows to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was Kevin Vance. Tonight's show was produced by our senior producer, Susie Britton. We'll be off for the next 2 weeks for the holidays. I'll be back on Monday, January 5th. This is Joseph Pache for my co-host, David Onick, and all of us here at City Visions. Thanks for listening. Good night, have a great week, and happy holidays.